Welcome to Real Estate Makes Us Drink. I'm Brian Quinlan from Daniels Real Estate.
Brad Nickum from Ness Mortgage Group.
Tell them who you are.
My name is Jake Query. I know nothing about real estate success, and every once in a while I drink beer. So I'm one for three. So, but now, if you want to call it how I make my living, I host a radio show on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan called Query & Company. I host a podcast with a guy named Derek Schultz that I used to do a radio show with. And I do turn announcing and play-by-play for the IndyCar Radio Network.
After the quick break there, we've got some Jefferson Reserve. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct.
Jake's choice, Jefferson. Here we go.
Some bourbon, baby.
Cheers.
So listen, this is what it says right here, right? If I need a mortgage, I got to give you a shot.
Give me a shot. That's right. Yep.
It's brilliant.
The poker chip says something too.
I always say don't gamble with your mortgage needs. And then there's a guitar pick over there because I play guitar, and I hand them the guitar pick with my cartoon. It has my cartoon character on it. They may not be over there, but I tell them to pick me. It says pick me at the bottom.
Good.
Yeah, I try to come up with all the corny.
You got
if there's
the giveaways,
corny marketing, I've come up with it.
You got the corny giveaways. I got the giant hat.
Yep. I was trying to come up with something with, you know, in a condom wrapper.
Yeah.
Let me protect you from making a mistake.
Fair enough.
All right, so what Jake just learned is that Brad's running a marathon in Hawaii. So this, by the way, Jake, this episode will be on YouTube live Sunday night.
Okay. And I'll probably just be finishing.
Be in Hawaii finishing his marathon. You have run the mini? Mm-hmm. Is that where you had a heart attack?
No, so I had a heart attack in October 20. So kind of right as COVID was kind of ending before the kind of that second surge that happened in the spring. So when I had my heart attack, the connection to the mini would be, so I'm sitting there and they come in and they tell me, and I know that I'm having a heart attack. It's pretty obvious. And they're saying, we got to get you in right now. And so I said to the doctor, I said, so I'm going to die, right? Because he said, look, you've got 100% blockage in your widowmaker.
So you had the widowmaker.
Yeah.
Wow.
I had 100% blockage widowmaker. And so I'm sitting there and they said, you know, we got to get you in. And the cath lab team is on its way in. They've all been paged and they're on their way in. And I remember I said, paged from where?
Exactly.
Right? Like, are they
from their kitchen table?
Right. Like, are they at the Red Robin across the street, or are they in a soccer match in Avon? Right.
Yeah.
There's a difference here. And he said,
two of them are at the Slippery Noodle.
That's right. So he said, they have
one chance to get here.
And he said, you're going to be in there within 15 minutes. And I said, okay. And that's when I said, so let's be real here. I'm probably going to die. Right. And he said, well, the 15 minutes is probably the most severe 15 minutes you've ever had. I said, okay. So afterwards, actually, I take it back. It was just before they took me in. So I'm just basically sitting there waiting to go in. And so the doctor comes in and I said, so let me ask you a question. Because I was trying to gauge just how screwed I was, right? And more so, I think I was trying to gauge how much my life had just changed, right? So I'm sitting there and I don't know if you guys have ever been through this, either one of you.
I've had heart surgery, yeah.
Okay, so, and how old were you?
44.
So I was 48.
I had AFib, so I had to have.
Okay. So was your scheduled or was it?
Yeah, actually, I thought I was having a heart attack.
Right.
And then it quit beating really hard. So I came home and didn't tell anybody. And then I told my business partner. He called my wife. She made me go to the hospital. And then I had to go to the heart surgeon. Then they scheduled it.
So you had an ablation, probably. Right?
I had an ablation. I had Wolf Parkinson White.
So, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay, how much has. Because in that moment, when you first find out, you think to yourself, so the life that I've always known is forever.
Going to be different, yep.
So I said, hey, let me ask you a question. And he said, okay. And I said, I've run the mini marathon every year since 2011 or whatever.
Why?
And I said, if I make it out of this, I'm going to do everything you tell me to do. I'll hit every benchmark you want me to hit from a health standpoint, every commitment I got to make. But if I make it out of this, what are the odds in May that I can run the mini again? And he said, man, that's almost impossible to gauge.
Correct. Yeah.
You know, there's so many things that have to take place.
I hope to talk to you when we're done.
Right. And I said, okay. And then I said, well, I'll make you a deal. And he goes, okay. And I said, if I make it out of this, I'll do everything you tell me to do so that I can run the mini. But if I'm able to run it, you're running it with me. And he goes, how far is that?
Yeah.
And I said,
it's just right down the road from here.
it's a half a marathon, right? I said, it's 13.1. And he said, man, I don't know. At this point, I don't know if I can do 13.1. He was like 35 years old at the time.
There's a picture of him up here. I'm pretty sure it's a picture of you and your cardiologist at the 500.
Yeah, because he spotted for me at the 500 after.
Yeah, so he's
the next day. So that was all that was said. And then when I went for my first follow-up a month later, I'm sitting there and he's going over everything. And
that guy right there.
There he is right there, Dr. Benjamin Mottman. That's him. Then he was spotting for me in turn three.
Awesome.
So we get done after my one-month follow-up and he says, yeah, man, I got to run. Actually, I'd sit here and talk to you all day, but I got to get running. He goes, because if you can believe this, he's like, I'm a moron, but I got to go meet with a trainer because I'm actually running the mini marathon. So then COVID happened and they canceled the mini again.
Yeah.
So I called him up, or he called me, and we met on the Monon on the 6 month anniversary. So my heart attack was October 22nd, and on April the 22nd, so the 6 month anniversary of my heart attack, we met on the Monon and did 13.1 miles together.
And then
we've done the mini together every year since.
Wow!
So he's done the mini with me every year, and he spotted with me at the 500 that May. A month after that, he spotted for me.
That's fantastic.
Great story.
And, you know, I will say this part, and I say this with credit to him, but this was a cool moment for me. You know, after my heart attack, the 500 of, it would have been May of 21, so it was Elio's fourth. You know, that was a unique 500 because everybody's, you know, we did the 500 in August of 20. Nobody's there. So now in 21, it's the first 500. It's 50%. But I mean, you know, the people are there, right?
Right.
So I asked Mottman if he wanted to spot for me. And he said, okay. So he spots for me. And so we get out to turn three and I broadcast from the top of the Vista. And we get out there and I said, well, there's stairs we can go up the back or we can go up right through the stands. And he said, let's go up through the stands. I said, okay. So we go up to the stands, and I mean, you know, everybody's greeting each other and whatever else. And you have that added emphasis of the fact that it was the first time that everybody had been together.
Right. Mm-hmm. It was all cool. They were all back in the same place.
Correct. So I'm walking up, and you know, a lot of people knew my story and knew what I'd been through. And so that was cool. People are saying hi and whatever else. So we get up, and we're doing the race. And that year, the race went forever before we finally had a caution flag. And then I think Graham Rahal had a tire issue, and so he hit the wall, and so we were under caution. So now we finally get a chance to take the headsets off during a break, and I look at him, I go, so what do you think? And he's like, this is unbelievable, you know? And I said, yeah, and he goes, man, I'll tell you what, though. He goes, I really should probably thank you here. I said, thank me? I mean,
here?
I'm here because of you.
You sent a balloon through my heart, right?
Right.
And I said, what do you mean? And he said, you know, he goes, I grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And he said, and growing up in Grand Rapids, I always wanted to be a doctor because I wanted to make an impact. And I had this vision of being a doctor in a community somewhere and making a difference and being a part of that community. I said, okay. And he goes, so I went to Michigan State and I went to med school in Michigan. And then I get down here for my rotation and now I live in Indy. And he said, but I'm not from here. And he's a younger guy, right? So he hadn't been here a long time. But he said, and so I just kind of was going through the regimen of what I do. And he said, and then the reason I wanted to go up through the stands instead of the back is because everywhere we've gone today, people have come up to you. And everybody that's come up to you has come up to you to say that they're thankful that you're here. And every one of them, I'm like, well, this is it.
Right. He's
right.
Yeah.
And he said, but I've seen the impact that you've had on people and the relationships you have with people. And for the very first time, I realized that my work, in fact, impacted this community. And that was to then see that and realize that when I had my heart attack, and I'm not disingenuous to say that I'm friends with drivers of the Indianapolis 500 or of the IndyCar series, yeah. But I'm around them all the time.
Sure.
Right. So certainly professional acquaintances at the very
least.
And the driver that reached out to me the most heartfelt and the most concerned when I have my heart attack was Castroneves. So to have Mottman up there and to have Castroneves win his fourth race in something that I had worked hard to get back to that point was one of the most like powerful moments and days of my life. So that picture is a very special photo.
That's awesome.
Nice choice on picture.
Well, and I put the picture of Tony and I at Dave Seago's 60th birthday, who also was a spotter for Castroneves.
That's right.
One day.
That's right.
So, yeah, that was, we were talking about you.
Well, how about that?
Well, you know, the first couple podcasts that we did this together, I realized right away that you didn't know what racing was really all about.
You didn't grow up in Indiana.
He's like, my son races a motorcycle. And he's like, oh, well, that's weird. Does he play football? No. And then now I think he's learning that racing is, you know, racing people are very tight people. It's really, the racing community is, and it's, we were motocrossers, but we have a lot of friends in auto racing. And it's, one gets hurt.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they're all there to pick them up. And what's really cool to see is one breaks down, and now I don't have to race against that guy that I know is going to beat me anyway. And that crew's getting them all the parts to make sure that guy can still race with him. You know, it's a different grain of people, I think.
I've seen Days of Thunder.
You've seen Days of Thunder. Yeah, but have you seen Talladega Nights?
Of course.
I mean, listen. You saying that you know racing because you've seen Days of Thunder is like me saying that I know your Illinois background because I played with Lincoln Logs.
Yeah, I mean,
that's not the same. Not the same. He's from Kentucky.
No, it's true.
So as a regular day-to-day sports guy,
yep.
Do you watch sports outside of your job for enjoyment?
You know, it's probably the one, there's really no drawback to my job, but I would say one of them is the fact that, so we'll go back to Ed Sorensen. When I was probably 20 years old, Ed said to me, he goes, Jake, listen, you're the biggest IU fan I've ever seen. You're a zealot about this, right? I mean, I knew scores and stats, and I mean, my life rested and my happiness was based on IU basketball. But he said, look, if you're going to be a sportscaster, you cannot be a fan. You have to be objective.
Oh.
And he said, so, and I never had design to stay in Indy. I mean, I just assumed that I was going to be taking a job anywhere.
Yeah.
But he said, what you need to do is you need to pick a team that's likely one that you're never going to cover. And that needs to be the team that you avidly follow. And that let that be your outlet. Paint your face. Wear a sweatshirt. Do whatever you can. And I said, well, when I was a kid, we would vacation in South Carolina, and I always liked Clemson.
Oh, okay.
And I said,
that's right.
So what about Clemson football? And he said, there's your team. Because I always had paid attention to him anyway. And so I came into work the next week. Not work, but loitering.
I was loitering.
Right.
The studio where I hung out.
Clemson sweatshirt sitting on the table. And he goes, there you go.
Oh,
Clemson,
nice.
Been my team ever since. So with Clemson, I'm that way. With other sports, I'll be honest with you, it's not that I dislike it, but I definitely see it. I watch it in a more sterile environment. However, my girlfriend was a diehard forever Pacer fan. Her father worked for the organization, so she had an invested interest in it. And so I know what it would mean for her if they were to ever break through and win a title. So for that regard,
maybe they could play defense. That would help.
Start getting some consistent outside shooting. But anyway, so the Pacers would be one of those as well. But yes, there is no doubt that you start to see it through. You have to watch it through an objective eye so that you don't get clouded by your fan emotion to be able to then break down what happens in a game.
Yeah.
So it does take away a little bit. And for the first 20 years of my adult life, when it came to games that I was going to, I was going there profession.
Yeah, right.
So I wasn't going there and tailgating and drinking and eating chili dogs and whatever else. I was
buried in the game.
Right. I was there covering the game. So it does change your opinion a little.
So being able to watch a game, not watch a game, you kind of still have to because you're on a sports talk radio show where people call in and, you know, have an opinion about the Colts game that they just saw. And you got to know what the hell happened in the game.
But it kind of goes back to, I don't disagree, but there's also an element of it of the way that your daughter watches the news. I mean, you can see everything in a very condensed version.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, I will say, especially with the Colts in particular, because they're the cash cow of the city, you know, I got to watch their games pretty specifically. But a lot of games are won and lost the same way.
That's so
look
true.
The stats in the box score and figure out what a team did or didn't do, and you can get you know, an understanding of it. And, you know, look, I won't apologize for this. I had a guy last year that jumped all over me because I mentioned on the radio that when the Colts played the Vikings in that game where they got up to a huge lead and then Minnesota came roaring back.
Just blew. Like, I was at that game.
I was on a cruise.
So I was.
You were at that game?
Yeah, I got. I thought you meant the one in Indy.
No, in Minnesota.
Yeah, okay, the one in Indy when they did the same thing. I was in a suite and I promised I'd never go to a game live again.
You're not allowed to go to anything. No. But that particular day, my dad, my parents are both still living. They're in their 80s. They're healthy, thank goodness. But my dad, it means the world to my dad to take the entire family to go see the Yuletide show every year at Christmas.
Okay.
And that particular year, he had bought tickets on, I think it was a Saturday, and they moved the Colts game.
Oh, yeah, they did.
From either Saturday to Sunday or whatever it was, but they moved it like the week of the game, the NFL flexed them. So it conflicted, and so I went to the Yuletide. And when I was on the air the next day, I said, look, I was at the Yuletide with my parents, and some guy sent me a thing like, you should be fired, da-da-da. And I'm like, you know what? My dad's 83 years old.
Right.
My whole family lives here. It's 3 days before Christmas, and it means the world to my parents to have the entire family there. I'll do it every time,
yeah.
No question about it.
One of my former students is one of the dancers in Yuletide.
Seriously?
Second year in a row, yeah.
It's a cool show.
Yeah.
It's a great tradition.
Definitely is. So you brought up South Carolina. You and I have something else in common. Hootie and the Blowfish.
Love Hootie.
As do I.
That's Darius Rutgers, you mean.
Anyways, you went to see Hootie this year.
Did.
And what'd you think?
It's great. Did you go?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I went to the one in Indy, though.
So I had this running, this weird thing where, again, it goes back to when I was talking about the stuff that you love from when you were in the chase, right?
Right, yeah.
And Hootie and the Blowfish was huge when we were in college.
Absolutely.
So it takes you back to that.
High school.
I always have wanted to see them, and every single time that they were in town, something popped up. I mean, like, literally, there was a conflict at the 11th hour every single time. And so, finally, I'm like, you know what? So I told Shannon, my girlfriend, I said, we're going to go to Nashville and go see Hootie and the Blowfish. So we went. It was great. I thought they were great. Collective Soul opened for them.
Yep.
Who, when I was an intern in college, I interned at MTV in New York, and Collective Soul was really big at that time. So that was cool. But it was fun. It was a nostalgic show. It was a fun show. And I think the thing that makes Hootie and the Blowfish great is they are a band that when you're there, you get the feeling that you're just with three guys in a...
Hanging out in a garage.
For sure.
Garage bar, hanging out, right?
So the first time I saw them was 2019. It was Hootie with Bare Naked Ladies and I forget. Maybe the best concert I've ever been to. And it was me and all these Gen X people out in the crowd. It was just like, we're just hanging out, having some beers, listening to Hootie.
They think it's classic rock.
Well, absolutely.
X, there are generations.
Yeah, yeah.
The younger people, I'll think.
I was going to say, I'm a Gen X.
Right. And so then this year, went to see Hootie again, and I loved the show. But I got to say, I was a little disappointed because he played maybe one song off of the new album, Perfect Circle, I think it's called. I like a lot of songs on there because I was kind of hoping there'd be a little more of that. But
yeah, it was definitely a cracked rear view, like,
yeah,
three types.
They do that though. They always say no one wants to hear the new stuff.
That's what they're through, right?
Because everybody's ticked, right? I mean, I'm a big Sammy Hagar fan. You go to see Sammy Hagar, if he didn't play Can't Drive 55, you're going to be like,
right,
what the heck?
So, 2019 was Hootie, then obviously he shut down in 2020. In 2021, he started doing Hootie down in Cancun. That they did for about 3 years in a row, and then this year they did not because they started to tour again. But I always wanted to go down to Cancun to see them because
cool. That'd
be friggin' awesome.
We always went to Luke Bryan's Crash My Playa and seen Hootie play there, but it was Darius Rutgers.
Hey, I'll tell you why.
I'd see Darius. I would.
I'll tell you who I saw, and I'm not a fan of the genre. I'm not an anti-country music guy, but I've never
been
a country music fan. But this year, actually, I went with Motman and Shannon and then Motman's wife, my doctor. We went and saw, and I was like, you know what? This is the new Jimmy Buffett. As I'm watching it, I'm thinking to myself, this is the new appointment viewing summer concert, like party celebration to celebrate summer Americana.
Yeah.
And I thought it was great. And I realized, because I'm not a fan of the genre, and people are like, yeah, dude, you're like 20 years old. Kenny Chesney.
Kenny Chesney's amazing.
He was great. He was a great live performer.
Oh, Kenny is off the charts. He's amazing. But honestly, most people that say they don't like country music, it's they have this mentality of old school country and Western Merle, and they haven't listened to the fact that Jason Aldean's just an 80s rocker. that has a little country twang to him. And Luke Bryan is just a great country singer that's got a great pop, rocky sound to him. And then
there's that one, maybe you don't know who she is, Taylor Swift.
Taylor Swift.
She was country.
She still is country. She's done an amazing job. Check out a friend of mine, a guy that I played guitar with and has come up through the ranks recently. His name's Riley Green.
Good.
Riley's amazing. He just won his first CMA award. It's a duet, and it's called You Look Like You Love Me. And the girl sings about the guy, and that's what she says. Say, hey, you look like you love me. They won a CMA award for it.
Well, all right.
Yeah, I mean,
it's really good.
Listen, I'm telling you, like, going to that show, as I was watching, I'm like, it was just, everybody's having a good time.
Everybody's fun.
And Hootie and the Blowfish, the same way.
I said this, you know, grunge killed rock and roll. Right now, I grew up in the 80s where everything was, let's go snort some coke and chase some girls and party, right? The whole Poison, nothing but a good time, right? Rock and roll was fun. Rock and roll was always fun, all the way up until Kurt Cobain said it wasn't any fun anymore. Yeah. And then the Foo Fighters, you know, came after that, and they kept that same grungy,
right?
Don't sing about something fun. And country music went, well, wait a minute. Let's get some girls in a pickup truck and some beer.
Yeah.
Let's sing about something fun, you know. So it's not necessarily about a tear in my beer like it was in the 80s and the 70s.
No,
it's more about a party
band that I had never. I mean, I got it, and it's certainly our wheelhouse. But like, people would throw you down a flight of stairs over them, and so that kind of turned me off to them. And then this year, I went and saw them, and I was like, okay, I get it, because they were great performers. It's Pearl Jam.
Oh, okay. See, now Pearl Jam, I call that down the ladder music. That means I'm all the way up at the top painting, and it comes on the radio, and I climb all the way down the ladder to change it.
I don't disagree. I mean, because...
But their show is really good.
I mean, every song is just, hey. But they were, yes, their energy, they were... And I got to hand it to them for this. I mean, they were completely on point, and they sounded like they did in 1994.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah, that's rare.
And they just came out, and it was just 3 hours of like a roller coaster ride. I mean, just boom. And in that regard, it was great. Now, I am going, and I'm psyched about this. I'll give you a trivia question.
Okay.
I'm Brian, your Indianapolis realtor. If you are looking to buy or sell a house in the Indy area, I'm your guy. If you're coming from out of state, want to make a move to the Indy area, I'm your guy. Check out the show notes for a link. We can get in touch and get you started. Thanks for watching. Now back to the show.
Okay.
We're the same age, okay? Not like the old guy down here.
Hey, thank you for pointing out.
I'm not 52 yet.
I'm going
but go
in
ahead.
July, knock on wood. I'm going in July to go see a band that I slept on. When this band came out, they were so hyped that it created an automatic turnoff because they were hyped before they even arrived. And then they arrived and they were big, but the D-bag level is off the chart.
Was it a creep?
Okay, very good guess. Very good guess, right? So, at the time of their era, I slept on them. I was like, yeah. Then I went back about 5 years ago and did like a deep dive on them. And I'm like, okay, I get it. And I was wrong. And so but they were no more. So I said, if they ever get back together, I'm there. And so I'm going in July to see them twice. But I've got to fly 8 hours to do it. Who am I going to see?
I guessed Creed.
I truly have no idea. I'm not anyone's music trivia person, so there's that.
I'm going to Manchester, England to see Oasis for two shows.
Oasis, okay.
Those are two brothers that ate each other.
Correct.
Just ate each other.
The level is completely off.
Like, they literally quit music because they wanted to kill each other.
That is correct.
They didn't even care if one of them died.
Brad, here's the thing. So their shows, because they're ultimately coming to the U.S., they're going to do, and they're doing like, you know, Chicago, LA,
right.
Atlanta, Toronto, you know. But I'm like, okay, if they are in fact reuniting,
get in early.
I've got to go to like,
you got to go to the first one. Yeah,
they might kill each other.
That's like going to see the Black Crows, right? Those two guys,
they
quit like the middle of the show. They're like, we hate each other, we're done.
And you know what? And they're the Black Crows, so that's a good one, because 2 years ago, I got a buddy that plays in a local band called The Elect, who are fabulous. And Michael and I, one day, I just called him and said, hey, I just saw the Black Crows are playing tomorrow. Deer Creek, whatever.
Better go see it now.
So we went, and because they were dialed in, and I think this is the advantage when you get guys to become our age, because, you know, you finally matured a little bit, right?
But yeah, sure. I don't really care. These dudes, we'll do our job.
Right.
We got to get paid.
And they were dialed in, and they were awesome. They were so good. They're so talented. But yes, I mean, you get these guys that, if you go back to their 30s, I mean, Axl Rose, I'm the biggest Guns N' Roses fan on the planet.
Yeah.
And Axl Rose is unquestionably one of the five biggest pukes ever to walk the face of the earth.
100%.
But he's an awesome.
But when they toured together, the last tour, my wife and I were in Nashville. I was doing some studio stuff with a friend down there, and I went for a run, and I ran across the bridge, and all of these semi trucks were parked at the stadium there. It was LG Field there, and I think it's Nissan.
Nissan Field, yeah.
Nissan Field. So I was running back to the hotel we were at, and I was like, Tony, something's going on at the football stadium tonight, so Google it. And she's like, it's a Guns N' Roses concert. And I was like, that's kind of cool. So we were down there in the afternoon, and I know this from a guitar player. I heard an A chord played at the highest volume, just, and it's something I've always wanted to do. And so we walked across the bridge, and they were doing sound check. And she's like, it's too bad it's sold out, because she looked and it was sold out. And we walked down to the stadium, and they had $35 seats available that they had opened some up. So they were right. We had Elon Musk had to take us to our seats.
Okay.
That's right.
They would fly up there. The opening act was Chris Stapleton.
Oh, well, he's pretty good.
Which was phenomenal. And then they came out on time. They came out on time.
That's the thing. Yeah.
Like, I was ready for Guns N' Roses to start like 4 hours late.
Right.
They came out on time. Axl was amazing. The band was amazing together.
Slash is incredible.
Oh, Slash is, and Izzy was there. You know, Izzy and Axl are both from Lafayette, Indiana, right? So they just killed it. It was a great show. And I walked to there going, man, I'm glad I got to see a Guns N' Roses show because I'd never seen one.
$35?
So that tour, I don't know if I should admit this or not. I saw
it. Go for it. No one's watching.
Las Vegas.
Hit with tens of people.
I saw him in Chicago. I saw him in Cincinnati.
Oh, so you did.
Saw him in Louisville. Saw him in Toronto. I saw him again in Louisville. And I saw him in Indy.
That's awesome.
So, yeah.
I seen him in Nashville.
Nashville would be a cool place.
You did what I used to do with Van Halen concerts. I would go, like, as a kid, I've actually seen Van Halen in concert. We totaled up one time, like, 41 times. And then I've been to Sammy Hagar's birthday party in Cabo every year since like 2003.
I don't know if you know this or not, but Jeff Spicoli blew all of his reward money from saving Brooke Shields by having Van Halen play at his birthday
party. That doesn't
been surprise there for me, right?
Jeff Spicoli is the best line in any movie ever. I'll still hold this down as the best line in any movie ever today. Who ordered this pizza? Well, Mr. Hand, that was me. I figured we were here on your time and my time, so I have a little pizza on our time.
That's wrong. A little feast on our time.
Yeah.
And about Cuba having some food.
And who sang the theme song to Fast Times at Ridgemont High?
The theme song itself, well, there are several, but
the one that goes, Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Boy, that's good. Is it on the soundtrack?
Yeah.
It's got to be, right?
Yes, yeah, the lead song.
So you got Jackson Browne's on there.
Do we need to call JMV?
Seriously.
I'd love to make this the trivia question, but I'm going to tell him the answer.
That's right. There's a trivia question today.
Give me the first letter of the band name.
S.
So I don't know.
Sammy Hagar.
Is it really?
Yeah. And remember the arm wrestling movie?
Over the Top.
Yeah. Over the Top?
With Stallone, right?
Sammy Hagar, Over the Top. He wrote that song and sang that theme song.
And I never would have guessed that about Fast Times. I'm ashamed of myself.
Fast Times Original High. Yeah, go back to the soundtrack, and Sammy's the main song.
I've never seen the whole movie.
And another song in that movie is Heavy Metal by Sammy Hagar.
You've never seen Fast Times?
I've not seen the entire movie.
Like the eighth grade.
Well, wait, you guys are the same age.
Did you ever see any Porky's movies?
Probably discreetly.
Have you seen the Phoebe Cates scene?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you got to look that part up.
I understand why you might not have made it past that.
That's true. I was good at that point.
All right.
So you have a guitar upstairs.
That's an EVH Wolfgang Eddie Van Halen guitar.
There you go.
Yeah. But I have four or three amazing paintings that are originals by Aaron Hagar, Sammy Hagar's son, who's a friend of mine.
That's cool.
Okay, so I have a question for you.
Oh.
So now that you're doing the podcasting, and you probably interview a lot of people, right? Mm-hmm. And if you could have absolutely anybody on your podcast, dead or alive, who would be your, like, gold star, amazing interview, your favorite person that you could sit down and talk to on your podcast and ask them any question you
want? I mean, are we speaking realistically and legitimately?
No, no. Dead or alive, the most amazing person that you would love to interview and find out more about their life.
And I don't mean this flippantly. It's going to come off that way. I mean, obviously, I think, and I'm not even an overly theological person, but like Jesus Christ would be fairly interesting.
I think that's
fairly.
But if you were asking my own personal taste as opposed to what I think would, you know. I'll tell you one person that I always wanted to interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm prepared for you guys to leave as soon as I say this answer. Ever since I was a kid, I was fascinated, and I don't want this to come off the wrong way and be misconstrued, but I was fascinated with everything that happened with the Manson murders.
To talk to Charlie Manson and find out why.
Charles Manson a letter because he lived in Indianapolis.
Right.
And I wrote him a letter about asking him a question about Indianapolis, and he wrote me back.
No kidding.
And so.
That's helter skelter, man.
Yeah. I mean, that. But I think just to.
Do you still have the letter?
I do.
Okay.
For all of the reasons that, I mean, I think he would be fascinating just because there are so many things about him, not him. You know, as I've gotten older, I've realized he was a, but there was something about, like, what was it about him that allowed
his magnetism? How did he draw people in the way he did?
And why could he not have channeled that in for good?
Yeah, exactly. For real.
But anyway.
Maybe he thought it was good somehow.
You know,
there's a lot of people like that, though. If you think about it, Pablo Escobar.
Totally.
Like, built a business then bigger than what Amazon is today, right? I mean, the ability of what he built, one of the first billionaires in the world, but had this incredibly evil side. Think if he had channeled that for something good. You know, a lot of the major drug dealers in the world, you're like, oh, man, how did you do it? Like, besides just killing off all of your bad people.
Part of that.
Michelangelo would have been fascinating.
Mm. Oh, man. Da Vinci, I think it'd be pretty fascinating.
Da Vinci, either one of those two. Galileo. But Michelangelo, I think, I'm very fascinated by, and I've read a lot about and studied about and was very moved by seeing Michelangelo's David. So being able to talk to him about the process of that and being able to take something that was believed to be impossible to sculpt because it's marble that was so porous that it would have been impossible to do it, and then turn it into the greatest masterpiece in the history of mankind.
Yeah.
To ask him about that would have been pretty fascinating. There are, I will tell you this, to say that I do this every night would be a lie, but I would say 80% of the time, when I go to bed at night, the last thing I do before I go to sleep is I think of something that I've always heard about but never really known about, and I look it up. Hmm. I spend 10 to 15 minutes reading about it. And so the answer to your question is infinite.
Sure.
Because there's always something different that fascinates me. And the quest to always learn about the unknown, it doesn't have to be unknown to everybody else, but if it's unknown to me, the quest to learn about that is probably what continues to drive me each day to learn something new. So literally, you could ask me that question, and I could probably give you a different answer every single day, to be honest.
Okay, so then I'm going to go the opposite direction. It's 1992. IU just lost a basketball game that they were supposed to win.
Yeah, that would be Duke, because I got screwed by Ted Valentine.
And you're in the press corps.
Yep.
And you are next, and you have to ask Bobby Knight a question. What would be the scariest question to ask that man?
So I will tell you this. I've interviewed Knight a million times. Not a million, but a lot. He hung up on me once.
Of course he did.
So that would be one. Actually, I think if you were to ask a question to him in 1992, and only a diehard Indiana fan would remember this, but I probably would say something like, Coach, when you look back on the beginning of your Final Four run here, you caught a lot of static over your incident with the bullwhip, and how much of that actually deflected attention from your team onto yourself and benefited you in your wins that you took through the NCAA tournament here, starting out when you were playing in Boise, moving to Albuquerque, and now here to Minneapolis. And then I would have let him.
I would say that if Trump could appoint somebody as press secretary, and he could choose anybody in alive or dead in the world, I would want it to be 1997 Bobby Knight.
Can you imagine?
Could you imagine?
The press conferences would have lasted 2 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Dumb question next. And most of it would be bleeped out.
That was my freshman year at IU, the 92 Final Four. And I remember watching the Elite Eight game with Kentucky and Duke. And I think it was Mashburn who hit a three from the corner before.
Terrible. I mean, here he is working against a 6'11 guy. Not your highest of percentage shots. But as I mentioned, it goes in. What can you say?
Christian Laettner.
Sean Woods.
Ended it. Okay.
Sean Woods from Cathedral.
I just remember, like, dancing around the lobby of Wilkie, like, oh, Duke lost. We're going to play Kentucky. I was like, and then fucking Laettner.
Time out so they can get in better shooting range.
There's the pass to Laettner. Puts it up. Yes!
That shot was unbelievable.
Oh, unbelievable.
So Sean Woods, who was from Cathedral and played on a really good Cathedral team that won the sectionals in 88, and he played with Noble Duke, who was a really good player. They had a shooting forward by the name of Matt Pointer, not Painter. Might have been Mark Pointer. Mark Pointer, really good player.
Actually know that one. Can you believe that?
and that team was really good. And Sean Woods, I always kind of felt bad for Sean Woods because he was obviously a big recruit because he went to Kentucky. He was part of that group that helped bring Kentucky back. But he hit a floater through the lane off the glass that theoretically beat Duke. And that group called the Unforgettables, which, you know, had all of those players that came to Kentucky after they'd had the whole Emory Air Freight disaster and they were on probation, and Jamel Martinez and Darren Feldhaus and John Pelfrey and Sean Woods and that group. If Laettner doesn't hit that shot, Sean Woods is as much a legend in the state of Kentucky as Secretariat.
For sure.
Wow.
But Laettner hits that shot, and so it becomes...
Hey, and I thought it was Jamal Mashburn.
But that's sports, right? That's exactly right, right? Mashburn got there and was... Well, he would have been there, I guess, then. But in 93, when they went, Indiana went down to Freedom Hall, and Farmer and Travis Ford and Mashburn just killed that Indiana.
Is Travis Ford still playing there?
No kidding. He was there for 20 years. That Indiana team in 93 lost four games. They lost to Kentucky. They lost to Ohio State and Lawrence Funderburk, who had transferred to Kansas twice, the beginning of the year and the end of the year. Oh. Great team, 30-4.
Yeah, they were super good.
Really good
team. Super good. All right, so we're going to start to wrap this up. One of the things I have to say I appreciate about you that always resonates with me is listening to you on the radio, and you are a very genuine person. I got in touch with you because you give out your personal cell number to people on the radio. And I don't think you do this anymore, but you used to say on Thanksgiving, pre-Thanksgiving to people, if you don't have anywhere to go on Thanksgiving, you do. Okay. Here's my number. Give me a call. You can come hang out with me. I think that's awesome. I know that you have brought people who have come from Australia who've never been to the 500, that you have gotten them tickets and, you're still friends with them.
Oh, yeah.
I believe, that to me, really resonates with me. So thank you for that. You're a very genuine person.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, I like I've told you guys, I mean, I'm really lucky because I don't really have a job. And I grew up in Indy. I have a love for Indy. I have a passion for the city itself. But I have a passion.
You're going to be the mayor, right?
I am going to run for mayor someday, yeah.
But we need to talk.
But, you know, look, the reality is this. To love a city means you've got to love everybody in it. You don't get to pick and choose which people are valuable parts of the city. And there are people who feel like they don't have a value. And so just because life might be hard for them, or maybe they moved here and they don't know anybody, or maybe, you know, they're an only child and their parents have passed or whatever, there are certain times that you want to make sure that people don't feel alone. Thanksgiving's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So when I worked years ago in St. Louis, and I was stuck in St. Louis, I couldn't go home because I had to work the next day, and I understand it. Nobody that, people I worked with were like, so what are you doing for Thanksgiving? I'm like, well, I got to work on Friday. They're like, oh, that sucks. Yeah. No, we get like 28 people to come. Anyway, I had a good one.
That's right.
And my mom was mortified by it. So my mom, when I worked at Channel 6, when I came back, would have me send an email internally to everybody at the TV station, which is pretty transient business. Look, if you can't go home, come to our house.
Right.
So they did. So then once I got on the radio, I thought, you know what? You gotta walk the walk, right? If you're gonna talk it. So I just started saying on the radio and sending out on social media. If you are in Indianapolis and you don't have friends or family that you can gather with for Thanksgiving, you're more than welcome to join us. It's very informal. And my sister actually gets all the credit because she hosts it. She lays out a tablecloth and everybody has to sign it. And we see people, you know, we have a lot of people that have become friends. They come back the next year. They come back the next year. And it's fun to see their name on the tablecloth for a couple different years. And it's fun to look at the tablecloth and remember people like, oh, yeah, I remember so-and-so that now lives in North Carolina. And the number of people that have come for that, that after the fact will send me a message and say, listen, like, you don't know what that meant to be able to be around people and around laughter and around conversation during Thanksgiving. I had forgotten that. And that's what it's all about. And so if I have the ability to have that platform to be able to talk to people, and if it weren't for those people listening, I wouldn't have a job and I'd have to get a real one. So I just feel like with the privilege of having that microphone and having that platform comes with it a responsibility. And that responsibility is to make sure that everybody in this city knows that they are a part of something that makes us different than other places in the country. And that is the openness to being able to invite everybody in.
So you say that. My daughter moved out to Las Vegas right after Memorial Day this year. And she talked early on about how she didn't necessarily like where she was working. She was bartending at a place called Lazy Dog there in Vegas. And she said, you know, the people here just aren't very welcoming. Like, no one wants to, no one's talking to me, you know, whatever. And I said, you know what, Alex? Hoosier hospitality is a real thing. And it's not just something people say. You know, connecting with what you just said there, it's very real. And you are an example of that. And something else you did on your radio show, this was a couple of years ago, you sat down with, was it homeless people? I think like a homeless person for so many straight weeks.
Yeah. So I know we're up against it, but I'll tell you this. When I was a kid.
We're not really.
When I was a kid, my parents are both from Indy, and my mom, back in the day, there used to be hot dog carts all over downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And in the summertime, my mom would take me down to get hot dogs. And so we'd go down there and she'd say, well, listen, why don't you get five hot dogs and then find five friends and eat hot dogs with them? And so I would sit there, and then on the way home, she'd say, how many new friends did you make today? And my mom loves to tell the story where one time I said, I made 4.5 friends. Said, how did you make a half friend? I said, well, I talked to him and just didn't talk back.
Yeah, as a half friend.
But we did that a lot when I was a kid. And I would talk about the Reds and the 500 and IU and whatever.
Because that's all you knew was sports.
That's right. And then I got older. And one day my mom just said to me, she said, hey, do you remember our hot dog lunches? I'm like, well, of course.
How do you forget that?
Right.
And she said, you know what's interesting about that? I said, what? She said, you know, you didn't realize this when you were little, but all those people that you were eating hot dogs with were homeless. And I said, yeah, I mean, I think I probably figured that out. And she said, but that didn't matter to you. They were still, you had a common ground with them where they could be your friend. And you better never lose that. And so when I got laid off from a radio job in January of 20, and then in that spring, you know, I'm fortunate that people actually cared what I was going to do next. And I knew that you only have a short time in a period of your life where people care about that kind of thing. So people were asking what I was going to do, and I didn't know what I was going to do. But I thought, you know what? If people really do care what I'm going to do, and I'm not going to be working for a while because, again, non-competes, right? So I called Wheeler Mission, and I said, what if I continued my mom's lesson? And I come down, and for 30 days, I have lunch with a different homeless person every day for 30 days. And I'll call it 30 lunches in 30 days. And Hot Box Pizza got on board and said, we'll cover it. And so help of Wheeler Mission, that's right, 60 of them, right? Just one from a personal pan. So, So for 30 days, I would come down and meet it, and Wheeler Mission facilitated it because I had to get the permission from people to tell the story. But I went down and I had lunch with a different homeless person every day, and I would say to them, I'm not here to talk now. I'm here to listen.
You're not here to exploit them.
I'm here to
hear their story.
I'm here to be, at the very least, a half friend that is listening. And people would just open up and tell me, because nobody wakes up one day and says, I think I'll be homeless.
Absolutely not.
So I wanted to know what led them to that point to try to humanize their story and let people know. And the number one thing that I found in 27 of the 30 people that I talked to, 27 of the 30 experienced childhood trauma.
Oh, wow.
So things beyond their control, things that happened to them at an age before they could they really had control of their own destiny, right? And it only reinforced that I'm very lucky, as all of us are, to have experienced, you know, good things in life. But those things are attainable for people. They just sometimes need somebody to believe in them and to let them know that they're not alone in their journey.
Yeah, my wife is an administrator for Perry Township Schools. And one of her duties is she runs a food pantry out of her office every Tuesday. And occasionally I'll go there and volunteer to help give out the food and whatnot. And, you know, I often think to myself, you know, what got these people into the position that right. they're in, that they're, you know, here for free food every week. And there are many of them that are returners every week. Like, we'll be out and about. We were at Meijer the other day, and she was like, oh, that guy comes to my pantry. I was like, oh, interesting. I mean, you just never know someone's story. Totally. I mean, hell, people come to the pantry. I've seen someone pull up in a Hummer. I'm like, holy crap, what are you doing at a pantry? But I don't know their story. You know, they could be borrowing that Hummer from somebody.
Well, people, you know, I know in distributing food also, different things like that, a lot of times you see somebody and you think, really?
Yeah. But
then you find out that they're actually there on behalf of somebody
exactly.
else who doesn't want to be there,
you know, or,
who has the pride that, you know, doesn't want to have.
Potentially, they bought that Hummer and now they're out of money.
That's true too, yeah.
You just never know someone's story.
Well, you hit on another point of the whole success thing that we talk about all the time is you're leading with your heart, and you've been taught, obviously, from a young age to accept people where they are and lead from your heart, and that's phenomenal to me. Thank you for doing that. Thanks for being the person that you are.
I appreciate that. I'm just a dude, right?
Yeah, but you're not. So that's the thing. You say that, okay? So we all say things that we want to knock down a lever, right? We want to, look, I'm not that. Let's be real. Come on. I'm just a normal guy. I just work every day. And yeah, right. We are. We work every day, our normal thing. But when you step out and you help people and you lead with your heart and you work hard, you have the convictions that you have, you woke up as a kid and said, you hung up on me. Yeah. You tried to smash my dream. And you know what? My dream is not smashable. So you say you're sorry. Okay, well, come down to the studio. The people forget the fact that every once in a while, you got to stand up for yourself. Two, you got to believe in yourself. And then three, you got to figure out how to make that serve other people.
Right.
And you've knocked those out of the park. So, I mean, I appreciate you being on the show. I appreciate what you do. I'm now going to start listening to sports radio.
Do I get the poker chip?
Yeah, you do.
You keep the shot glass, the poker chip. You can even take that agave plant home if you want to. I told Brian, I know I haven't told this, I want to put an agave plant on each side and change the name of our show to Between the Two Agaves. I like Between the Ferns.
I like that.
Give me the tequila name again, too.
No, this is Lost Lore Tequila. This is a fantastic tequila. Arturo Lamas, he actually grew up in Chicago. His parents were, he was a migrant worker, came from Mexico to California, and then they ended up in Chicago. And Arturo went to college. He started a business. He actually has a huge furniture company. They sell furniture to Wayfair and Target and these big companies. He also started a brewery in Chicago. And
wow.
His dad, his grandpa, his great-grandpa all come from making tequila. And he realized that he was going to be the first person in multiple generations to not make tequila. And went, okay, we've got to go back.
It, right?
We need to make tequila. That's the name of the lost lore, right? He almost lost the tradition. They wound up at a fantastic distillery, 1414, the Vivancas Distillery. Sergio Cruz is the master distiller.
Hola, Sergio.
Sergio's the best. They went back to this true traditional way of making tequila. It's some of the best tequila you'll ever have. And Arturo is just a fantastic business person. And just same thing. He's got the heart for what he does. He loves the tradition, and he's such a helper of people. And it's about finding people like that. Those are the people that succeed in life. So
very cool. Very cool.
All right. Well, on that note, thanks for watching. Be sure you subscribe, share this episode, because there's a lot of gold nuggets in here that Jake shared and Brad shared, and I sat here and listened to.
Nah, you did it too.
And we always appreciate you being here, gents. Cheers.
I'm out.
That's cheers. All right. You're down a second.
If you're listening to us on one of the podcast channels, it really helps if you like and review on the podcast channel on Apple Podcasts, because it moves us up that level. So if you could do that for us, that'd be fantastic.
All right. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time on Real Estate Makes Us Drink.
Cheers.
Makes Us Drink.